Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Anoush.
I'm Alva.
And I'm Stephen.
On today's New Statesman podcast, we discuss what we're most interested in finding out from the local election results. And you ask us, does Labour have a positive enough vision? So we're recording on what is being called Super Thursday, when people are voting for elections to the Scottish and Welsh parliaments, 143 councils in England, 13 directly elected mayors in England, and 39 police and crime commissioners in England and Wales. And of course, if you are a voter in Hartlepool, you'll also be voting for your next MP. We don't want to make any predictions in this podcast because obviously it's going to come out when some of the results have already been revealed. So we're going to speak more about what we'll be surprised by or what we're looking out for in these results and hoping to learn something new about politics from them. So the sort of unknown unknowns, if you like. Alva, what are you most looking forward to sort of finding out from these elections?
So I suppose my honest answer is that I'm most looking forward to seeing what happens in Hartlepool, with the caveat that I know that that is ridiculous because the by-election in Hartlepool is not existential in the way that the Scottish parliamentary elections are. I feel personally quite critical of the way Hartlepool has dominated conversation, certainly in English political discourse over the past few days, but I'm still kind of swept along with it. And so I think especially having been there recently, I'm interested to see what that result is. Listeners who have been following will know that there was a not terribly reliable looking poll that indicated that the Conservatives could win in Hartlepool by 17 points, which I think is likely to be wrong, but it is quite likely that the Conservatives will win there. I'm just really interested to see what the result actually looks like. And then I think it'll be no secret to people who heard the last episode that I wasn't terribly impressed by the choice of candidate, the Labour candidate or actually the Conservative candidate in Hartlepool. But I'm particularly interested to see whether Paul Williams, the Labour Hartlepool by-election candidate, performs better or worse than all of the other Labour candidates who are being elected in Hartlepool. So how he performs relative to the local councils and so on. Because I think we've had all of this mad discourse about how Keir Starmer is or isn't doing and whether the Labour strategy is and isn't working. And I think actually I'm dying to actually have a result from there so we can discuss that properly without sort of skipping the important bit where we actually hear the results.
Stephen, what about you?
So I feel bad about this being the thing that I'm most intrigued by, it because it possibly A, doesn't matter and B, may never actually be useful information again. But this is the first time that we've had local council elections on the same day as Metro Mayor elections. And we know, for instance, that Andy Burnham did 20 points better than the Labour Party in 2015. In May 2017, so in a much worse set of elections for the Labour Party than the 2015 general election, Andy Burnham did better than the Labour Party, and he actually did better than the Labour Party than the Labour Party would go on to do across the Greater Manchester Combined Authority in June 2017, a much better set of elections than the 2015 election. We know that Ken Livingstone did significantly better than the Labour Party in the London local elections in 2008, a much worse political backdrop for Labour than the 2006 local elections. We know famously that Boris Johnson won re-election in 2012 in the only sort of uncaveatedly good set of local elections that Labour has had since leaving office. But what we don't know is, if you have a Metro Mayor underneath, running, and underneath you have a bunch of council elections, what happens to the council elections, right? Because I've been talking to people across the conurbations, and one of the, I think, you know, the whole way that we've started having by-election and local elections discourse before the result is just really driving me round the bend. But it's particularly stupid with the, a good way to work out which journalists just uncritically repeat the spin they're given. Are anyone suggesting then what will be indicative in this election are the Metro mayoral results? It's just like, yes, they were really indicative in 2017 when Chris Green notably did not lose Bolton West in a 20-point landslide. The point of having a mayor, right, the advantage of them, and they are drawbacks to them as well, but the advantage of them is the idea that they can have a localized mandate that means that they don't get swept aside because their party is doing well or badly. Yeah, I was talking to a Conservative councillor, Conservative council candidate who very much did not expect to win at the start of this process and is not sure whether or not they are going to now, because they were saying, it's so hard to tell, right? You knock on a door and then we have listed as, voted Labour, voted for Andy Street. And they go, yeah, I love Andy Street. I think he's done they talk about how particularly, like, if you're interested in civic society in the West Midlands, right, you are quite likely to go, yeah, I usually vote Labour, but I really like, what he's done with, there's some really exciting bits of urbanism he's doing. And they said, they couldn't work out is when I then went, and are you going to vote for me? And they kind of went, yeah, of course, I will also vote Conservative. It was like, they're like, is this someone being polite because I'm asking them? Or is this someone who is telling the truth? And I basically had exactly the same conversation about another Andy Burnham in Greater Manchester, where the reverse conversation, right? Knocking on doors where they know that these are people who voted UKIP and Conservative, but have also voted Andy Burnham. And he was saying, he goes up this drive, this guy, he's washing his car, and he puts a big thumb up. He's like, Andy Burnham, voting for him. And I was like, are you going to vote Labour in the local council election? And they were like, yeah, Labour, them too. And it's just like, well, is that them too? Obviously, if they'd done it as unenthusiastically as I did there, I think it would have been pretty obvious they were to be long. But we just don't know. I'm just so intrigued about it, not least because, in Hartlepool, I suspect that despite our well-advertised objections and criticisms of Paul Williams as a candidate choice, that we will not be able to say as much as it would satisfy me to be able to go, if they hadn't picked him, they would have won. But between the fact that there's a Metro mayoral candidate and a police and crime commissioner and the councillor, we're just going to learn so much about how much candidates do and don't matter in a way that I don't think we will ever be able to, which will be actually, I think, hugely useful for political parties, right? Because if it does turn out, then actually, let's say, as is widely expected, every incumbent Metro mayor wins and wins quite comfortably, but the council elections in Bolton, Tameside, Solihull, Wolverhampton happen as normal, then it would suggest something quite interesting about candidate effects. If, however, as I think is more likely, what happens is like a bunch of slightly improbable Conservative councillors are elected in parts of the West Midlands, and some slightly improbable Labour councillors are elected in parts of Greater Manchester. That would be, I just think, quite interesting.
Yeah, I'm interested in both of those parts of the elections that you've been chatting about. And I'm also going to be looking out for how the Green Party fares. Obviously, they did well in the 2019 elections, but that was a completely different context when there was a sort of a lot of dissatisfaction with the two main parties, and you've written your benchmarks up for what would be a good night or good election for the Greens, Stephen. But they do have this I think you do have an effect, don't you, from doing well in elections, is that you gain confidence. You gain confidence in your rhetoric. You gain contacts in the press. They've struggled for not being able to do the usual sort of shoe leather campaigning that they're so good at usually because of the pandemic. But what they've lost in that, I think they've replaced in a certain professionalism and maturity that I haven't really noticed has defined the Green Party as much as in recent times. So I'll be interested to see sort of where they make any gains, where they make losses, and whether or not it impacts that kind of new confidence that the party is demonstrating. And also sort of to identify which areas they should be targeting in future. Because in a way, the outcomes of these elections don't matter just in the sense of how much, you know, power you've gained or lost across the country. It also matters in terms of how it affects how you lead your party sort of in future debates on future policies and then in future elections as well. So it could change the course of how the party sort of presents itself. If it has a disappointing night, does it, you know, go back into its shell? Does it question whether or not it's pitched itself, you know, to the right side of Labour, for example, or not? So I'll be interested to see how they cope with whatever the outcome is over these elections. And then secondly, if I'm allowed a second one, it's a little bit more of a geeky one, but will voters remember what these elections are actually for? And also, how will the parties cope with the responsibilities that voters have given them? So what I mean by that is, if you're voting for the devolved parliaments in Wales or Scotland, are you voting on the basis of how the leadership during the pandemic has been? Because it's that the pandemic has really highlighted what the devolved areas are, you know, what your parliaments in those countries are actually in charge of. COVID-19 has been, you know, the perfect way of exposing where your first ministers have power. And so have people noticed that, or are they going to reward the Westminster government more for those things? And in terms of governments being able to take responsibility for where they have their powers, are they going to realise that, you know, when you're voting for your council, are they going to realise that people want, you know, people want to have a better council? So, I mean, I think that sounds like an obvious thing, but sometimes local government and local elections ignore what you're actually voting for in terms of your local authority, what services they run, what responsibilities they have. The pandemic has exposed lots of those responsibilities as well. So if the government, you know, has a good night and loses, you know, fewer councillors than it expected and can declare the elections a triumph, what will it then do, you know, in the councils that it's held, in the places where it's made headway in the new electoral map? We know that austerity is still ravaging local government. So, I mean, how are the Conservatives expecting to level up if they're going to let this carry on? And, you know, will they be as comfortable, neglecting local government if these elections reward them? It's a question that I don't think they can carry on dodging for very much longer, particularly as COVID-19 recedes. Levelling up was the sort of second plank of their manifesto after Brexit. And if they are going to neglect these councils for any longer and allow them to or compel them to make further cuts, as they are planning on doing in their next budgets, then, you know, they may find a lot of disillusionment and feelings of betrayal. We had a good poll. The New Statesman Spotlight supplement had a good poll of councillors, which showed that 59% of Tory councillors have said they've seen no benefit from levelling up in their local area. As that gets more acute, as the government gets more opportunity to deliver on its promises, then, you know, it might be tougher for the government in terms of how it appeals to voters in the kind of councils that it's targeting this time round.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. I raised the thing we haven't mentioned, partly because it's the thing which we don't expect to learn anything from. And I actually can't really see what result could happen that would tell us something that we didn't. Well, I mean, there are lots of results that will tell us lots of things. But what I mean is, I don't think this is the result where it's like, I wonder what these three outcomes could mean. But the least interesting result in some ways is, and I'm yet to, yeah, there is, every poll suggests this is what's going to happen. All four of the parties, that is huge, abolish erasure. All six of the parties in God, there's even more than that. Sorry, I will stop counting Welsh parties and make my actual point, which is that every party I have spoken to believes that the polls are right. Support for Welsh Labour has grown over the course of the campaign. I mean, yeah, as one Conservative said, what's essentially happened is that what you'd kind of expect, which is the weirdness of people saying to pollsters, yeah, I think the Welsh government has handled this better than England. Yeah, I really like Mark Drakeford. He just seems like a really nice guy. No, I think I might vote for Plaid or for the Conservatives. Although the Conservatives had done a very good job cannibalising quite a lot of the UKIP vote. They think what's also happened is the voters, yeah, the kind of, if this makes sense, the voters who in the polls kind of didn't look a bit weird, i.e. people saying, like the Welsh government, like Mark Drakeford, voting for Plaid Cymru, voting for the Welsh Conservatives, are now just saying, yeah, I'm going to vote for the Welsh Labour Party. I'm going to vote for the party led by the guy I like, which is wholly uninteresting in lots of ways. And, you know, I think just as I think you can't separate what's likely to happen to the Conservatives in England from the vaccine bounce, I think it's hard to go, maybe Adam Price should simply have found a way for the Welsh government not to have more vaccinated adults than any other part of the United Kingdom. But I think it is nonetheless really important and fascinating that after 22 years, the Welsh Labour Party is still going to be an essential component of the next Welsh government. London has become a Labour heartland. Scotland has very much not isn't very much not a Labour heartland. Seats that had reliably voted Labour up until 2010 have massively trended towards the Conservatives. And yet, the Welsh Labour Party, the dude abides. I can't believe I just compared Mark Drakeford to the Big Lebowski, but I did. But the dude abides. And I just think that is both the least interesting thing about these elections, but also just such a fascinating story in its own right.
Great. Well, hopefully on our next podcast, we can dissect what the results have actually shown. If you've been enjoying our podcast and want to find out more about what we think, and some of our colleagues too, then why not subscribe to The New Statesman? You can get 12 weeks for £12. Go to newstatesman.com/subscribe12.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
And now it's time for a section we like to call
You Ask Us.
So our question is from Matt Taylor. Thanks, Matt Taylor. A lot of criticism of Starmer and Labour is that they're not setting out a positive view of their plans for England and the UK. One, is that fair? And two, what would such a view look like? And three, do they need to set it out at this stage of the electoral cycle? That's three questions. He slipped three questions in there very sneakily. Stephen, do you think that Labour is still not striking a positive enough tone?
I kind of think they have the reverse problem. Labour have too many policies, and that's why people keep being like, I mean, what I really love about so much, like, what these results and haven't happened yet show the Labour Party should do, is I am yet to read a solution. Like, the only ones where the solution is something which the Labour Party isn't doing are when it's reinstate Jeremy Corbyn. You might argue that some of the ones which claim they want other things, actually, that's what they're objecting to. But yeah, like I have read Polly McKenzie claiming that, their problem is that they think that, you know, like being like brave, clever and right will help. You know, it's just like, I think you would have to love Keir Starmer so much that he had a restraining order against you to think that the problem of this Labour Party was just it wakes up every morning and goes, let's just say what we think is the right thing. You have people saying, yeah, I saw like a thread which I thought was exactly right about the electoral importance of having a visible green policy. Going, but they haven't really added anything. It's just like they announced a huge set of quite interesting green policies and then, you know, let them sit in the air undisturbed for maybe 2 hours before going, by the way, we have a couple of objections to the coronavirus policy. I'm going to have the massive disclaimer that I think that while that's a huge problem, it is a clown's take to believe that if they hadn't done that, then these local elections would go differently. These local elections are going to go the way they're going to go because 60% of the country thinks the pandemic is the greatest threat facing the UK, and an even larger group of people think that the vaccine rollout has been handled well by the respective governments in charge of it. Despite what I said about how it is, I think, interesting that Welsh Labour is going to be re-elected, it would also be quite surprising if they weren't, and if the SNP weren't, and the Scottish the Conservatives in England weren't. I kind of think at the moment the Labour Party is kind of like someone who's like needs to cut down the booze and the fags, who then gets knocked down by a car because like they didn't look both ways. Or actually, I guess I don't think they really had the look both ways option. They get knocked down by a car because the car mounts the pavement and drives over them. And people go, oh, the problem was the booze and the fags. And it's like, I mean, no, it wasn't. Don't be a clown. And what would it look like? I think it would look like, I think it would be two things, basically. Just for them to hammer their green agenda, their positive offer for left voters, and indeed voters of all stripes in the United Kingdom, fortunately, are into tackling climate change. And then their sort of their crime policy, where they, oh God, it has got to that point in the podcast already. They just do need to make access for justice a thing. They need to do what they did in the early 90s with NHS waiting lists, where they turned a real problem into a tangible weapon. And those should be the two things they do. Basically, just so he has the vibe of Keir Starmer's Labour Party, they hate climate change, they hate criminals. Everything they do should reinforce one of those two things until 6 months before the election, when that is the point for your policies to be new and exciting, as opposed to this thing where they have, more policy announcements than you can shake a stick at. Why do it?
Alva, did you notice that there was much sort of positive messaging from Labour politicians that you went around with in Hartlepool?
Yeah, I think that's a good place to start, because I think that there are actually so many things you could say in answer to this question that probably the case study of Hartlepool is an easy way in. I suppose the strange thing about the election in Hartlepool is that there are no dividing lines, that I can't really think of an election like this, where in the town, basically, everyone is in agreement about what the issues are. There's a real lack of jobs. Liberty Steel is closing down. There's a lack of investment. There's a problem with crime, so demonstrated by the closure of the magistrates court and the fact that the custody suite in the police station was closed down in recent years. So you can't try criminals in Hartlepool anymore, and you can't hold them in cells in the town either. And then there's the issue of the hospital. Those are the themes that come up everywhere. Those are all in different ways just sort of symbols of how basically everyone in Hartlepool feels that they have been very badly served by politics. That's the consensus. And then on top of that, there's this narrative that I just touched on, that they feel like they've been badly served by politicians, and they're angry with politicians and with the political system. And you notice when I summarised all the things that have closed there, I didn't say who by. In most cases, it's the result of the Conservative government, Conservative decisions and Conservative cuts. But I think that those links are not that clear for lots of people. And the Labour MP, to state the obvious, the Labour MP in Hartlepool had to stand down amid allegations of sexual harassment. Until recently, the Labour-held council in Hartlepool was sort of dogged by allegations of bullying, and there was this general sense that the councillors were out for themselves and really stopped listening to people in Hartlepool. So there's this feeling of just being badly served by politics rather than by any one party in particular. Or when I think you find it, when you put it to people, who in particular do you feel let down by? People feel let down by Labour more so than the government that has been in power for over a decade. And so Stephen and I were talking about this, and, I was saying, it's tricky that the Conservative narrative in Hartlepool is exactly the same as the Labour one. What was Paul Williams promising? He's identifying, a lack of police on the streets. What's the Conservative candidate promising? More police on the streets. Boris Johnson's up promising that. And Jill Mortimer, the Conservative candidate, is, looking down the camera and saying, you've been taken for granted for far too long. They have exactly the same message, but people are buying it from the Conservatives more. And I think there is really a feeling that the Conservatives are the ones who can actually provide that investment because of their levelling up agenda, that if you have a Conservative MP, you're more likely to see that money. This is probably like a slightly different question to whether they have a positive vision. But Steve and I were talking yesterday, you know, what happens if the Labour narrative is the same as the Conservative narrative? And Stephen suggested that, you know, it's the government that wins if there's no challenge there. So I think that there actually is, I think Hartlepool is a really big example of the corner that Labour feels backed into, where the narrative is, the narrative that they would like to be putting forward, that there has been a real failure to invest in particular areas, a failure to listen to people, is the same one being identified being the Conservatives. They're saying, you know, you haven't been listened to for far too long and we're listening to you, and Labour's just copying it. So then in terms of a positive view of their plans, as Stephen was saying, Labour does actually have lots of plans. If anything, they're maybe a bit too detailed. They published this really, really comprehensive green recovery plan that, you know, was a huge, huge document. It wasn't just their vision post-2024, but a sort of interim vision post-COVID of ideas to put to the government. They have all of these ideas, but clearly people feel like they're not hearing a positive, simple vision for Labour's plans. And I think that a large part of the problem is that actually they do have these plans, but they're not any different to the Labour plans under Jeremy Corbyn. So they've kept the radical policies in a lot of cases, even though no one gives them credit for that, while moving away from Jeremy Corbyn in terms of his radical messaging and image, and, you know, and creating a really stark differential in terms of the response to Labour anti-Semitism. So even though the policy agenda is largely the same, the message that people are receiving is really different. I also just think that, you know, then there are some issues where Labour just doesn't know what it stands for, like on crime and on defence. I think the pattern of abstaining on things is so complicated that, you know, even sitting in a room of journalists not that long ago, none of us could remember how Labour had whipped its MPs to vote on a particular part of a particular defence bill. And that's our job for, you know, journalists from lots of different publications, because we don't know ultimately what Labour's direction on that is. They just sort of want to get away with not having a position because they find it too difficult. So I think it's a mixture of, like, they have a positive view, but they aren't getting a hearing for it because it's the same as Jeremy Corbyn. And then there are other things that they're too scared to take a position on.
I think the same as Jeremy Corbyn point is one that I just don't think people seem to have sufficiently understood, right? To me, the structural problem with the Starmer approach as it currently exists is that, so he's given, since he became leader, several speeches that are going to be terrible, and two I think have actually been good. One to the farmers, the NFU, to the National Farmers Union, about reaching out to rural areas, and just actually, like, it was a rare example of where, oh, you can see how this, hey, it's the same policies, but presented by someone who looks like they could play David Cameron in a movie. It's the only time when it's actually, I've sit there and gone, okay, I can see how this can work. But that was because it actually had a way that it was new, which it was like, here are the rural policy, yeah, here are, like, the rural and sustainability policies, which, I mean, actually, like, let's face it, it's not like Keir Starmer, another, like, North London-based vegetarian, comes at those policies from a different position than Corbyn, but presented not in a kind of, like, here's some sustainability policies for people in cities, but here's some the same policies presented in a way that is rooted in the concerns of the people in this room. And that's the only time I've gone, okay, I understand what you're doing, it's old but different. Whereas Keir Starmer giving a great speech about, like, oh, you know, this is why I care so much about tuition fees. It's just like, ultimately, so I'll change the channel. This is a policy you had in the last manifesto and the one before that. It is kind of definitionally not interesting. And it is really striking to me, yeah, the number of times someone said to me, like, they can't abandon X, or, like, they need to, like, recover the spirit of 2017. And it's just like, well, they have. plus they have a welfare policy now. You know, I mean, I think the people who think then junking the 2017 manifesto would necessarily change their position are wrong as well, albeit for very different reasons. But the germ of truth there is that Corbynism cannot be exciting again. you can think the policies are still necessary, as Starmer clearly does, particularly on tuition fees, right? Like, the offer has to be something that's actually new, not least because the electorally popular and dangerous bits of the 2012 offer are the stuff that the Conservatives have tried to blunt. Now, yeah, I think there's an open question about whether or not 10,000 more police or whatever number it is really matters, seeing as they're, you know, being forced to become social workers of last resort. And as a result, police in this country never actually catch any criminals anymore because they have to mop up from, you know, the various cuts elsewhere. But they aren't going to be able to get the joy that Diane Abbott did in 2017 by going police cuts, police cuts, police cuts. So they do need to find some way of making the old stuff sing a bit. And it can't only be that it sings a bit when they're speaking to farmers, as you know, as fond as I am of farmers, nonetheless.
Yeah, that's the big challenge, isn't it? Like, the policies are there, and the vision is the vision that Jeremy Corbyn laid out during his leadership. But I think it is about vibe, isn't it? And I do get a little bit of a deflated vibe when I see interviews with Labour shadow cabinet members, and even, you know, when you speak to people behind the scenes, who's the mood of the party doesn't feel very upbeat. Whereas there were times during Jeremy Corbyn's leadership, despite the factionalism and infighting, there were times when there was, you know, definite excitement, particularly after the 2017 result, and particularly after certain policy announcements, when there was a feeling of optimism within the ranks. And then, of course, it's a way of talking about your policies. So if you're announcing policies to change, you know, the status quo, the way the government runs certain things, you know, whether it's on education or health or social care or welfare, then, you know, some criticism is baked into that. So you are going to have to say negative things. And there's a lot of thinking on the left about how you reframe those arguments so that you're not leading with the negative. So you're not saying, well, you know, air pollution is at X amount because the government broke its promise on X target, so we would do this. Could you flip that round and say, you know, imagine a world where, you know, without air pollution, your child can cycle to school or whatever, and lead with the vision rather than the criticism? Obviously, it's really difficult because the only reason an opposition is announcing new proposals for policies is so that they can get into power and change things that they don't see as going particularly well. But it's, I think there's a lot of work being done on that, because there is a feeling sort of among policy wonks on the progressive left, or people, you know, people who have worked for charities and think tanks on this stuff for a long time, that the Labour Party still isn't getting that kind of framing right. You know, there's a feeling that they're sort of very good at talking about problems, but not so good about laying out the vision for what it would look like if they fixed the problems, or if they had a chance to fix the problems. I did a piece on low traffic neighbourhoods recently, and whether or not they'll sort of play a part in the local election results. And someone was explaining this kind of framing problem to me, that if you go, you know, on the radio and try and argue for low traffic neighbourhoods, and you know you're armed with stats about cars on the roads and pollution and how much rat running there is, then you're going to get less of a good hearing than if you sort of lay out what, you know, how nice it is to walk down a street that doesn't have motor traffic on it, for example. It sounds really simple, but it's that flip round that I think the Labour Party still needs to get right. And obviously the fact that they've got so many policies does get in the way of that as well. But it's easy for me to say, you know, I'm not a politician, but I do think that there would be... I think there's a chance to sort of change the way you talk about austerity and its impacts, or, you know, various other policies, the cronyism and particularly the cronyism. That's another good example where you could kind of lay out a vision for a Westminster and a world of politics and policy that sort of where the rules are fair. Another example is, say, you know, saying the economy is rigged or the game is rigged plays really badly with voters, because it just means that they feel like it's fated and they feel like everyone's sort of a part of it, rather than seeing a vision for where the economy can work for you, for example.
I think that this is a really good question, I would say, because right before we recorded this podcast, I had lunch with someone who, you know, it would be professionally obliged to follow all of this very, very closely and would be incredibly well informed. And they were saying that they're not entirely sure what Keir Starmer stands for. We've been talking about the Labour strategy and sort of dialing down the more divisive cultural issues and trying to unite their voter coalition around a radical economic message. And they were saying, well, where is that? Labour would say that it's still there. But I do remember within the past few months, I was taking part in a panel for UCL on whether we were going to see a leftward shift off the back of the coronavirus pandemic if things like furlough and a sort of more people than ever coming into contact with the state would see a lurch to the left in terms of more people supporting greater state intervention and so on, and also whether people would be more interested in radical interventions around changing the working week in a universal basic income, all of those things. So whether there's this sort of whether there is a big radical moment in our politics to present a really big grand vision. And I thought, well, To add value to this panel, I should try to see what the Shadow Cabinet thinks about this. So I made a few calls, and I have to say that at least one person I talked to was terrified of sounding radical. And the emphasis was very much on how Labour would be responsible with the public finances, on how, it's the new economic consensus that, you shouldn't, have tax cuts, or you shouldn't have austerity coming out of the pandemic, but, that they're doing it in their very sensible, safe way, and that they have economic orthodoxy on their side, which I knew already, and, which is absolutely, a core part of Labour's offer. But it did demonstrate that tension, that they didn't want to say, yes, we're full of exciting ideas, da 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 da. It was actually a question of vibe, that you can't go for the yes radical vibe and go for the yes economically responsible vibe in the same breath as easily as maybe you would think. And there is that tension there, because that was the difficulty when Jeremy Corbyn was selling this vision. People thought it sounded great, but weren't necessarily convinced by the economics of it and were worried about that. Labour's really trying to work on that. But it means, I think, that, if the person I was having lunch with doesn't think that Labour has a radical economic offer, and this person is incredibly well informed, then I don't think that the person sending in the question or the people criticising Labour for not having a vision are to blame for not understanding that it kind of does, because it's certainly not selling it. And I think we've all acknowledged the challenges that Labour has in selling that, but ultimately I don't think that positive vision is cutting through.
I think, to return to my chain smoker who gets hit by a car mounting the pavement, it's the flip side of that, right? Is the car because the chain smoker keeps drinking and eating too much fatty food? No. Is that chain smoker on a trajectory to live a long, emphysema-free life? No. I don't think any of the kind of, one of us uses the term, they just don't have a clear vibe, like every other week, basically. And is the lack of a clear vibe the problem today? No. But it obviously is a bigger problem than the problems they have today, all of which they basically just need to calm down, grit it out, and like that stuff will take care of itself. But I think they really do need to think about, exactly as Alva says, right? If you want to be reassuring, you've kind of got to, you can have plenty of radical policies if you want, but I just continue to think that the Labour Together idea of you're reassuring and you're radical, I'm just you're one or the other. And I kind of think that if you look, if you have a strong chin and you look like you're from central casting and you have a very corporate style, right? He has a very corporate style of leading I don't mean that in a business sense. I mean, he has run a big modern organization, right? That is the way Keir Starmer approaches politics, the way he approaches running the Labour Party. Now, he also has a bunch of views about how he wants society to change. And yes, he is leading the Labour Party in a position to the left of Ed Miliband, but But he's never going to convey that. I actually think it would be better off if their vibe was duller than they are. Like, I think the Cameron thing is exactly it, right? I think you say now David Cameron was to the right of Boris Johnson's government, and people just do seem to think you're just like, you know, you're crazy or you're a Lexiteer. But it's true. It's just that Cameron could not have presented himself as anything other than I'm just a nice guy with a Bowden jumper. Whoopsie. Did I just shrink the state? And I think if there is a path to victory for this Labour Party, it is a kind of similar kind of, I'm just a calm and boring guy and we wouldn't do anything bad. Oh, by the way, have we taken quite a large chunk of the economy into state ownership? Oh, well, I must have been one of them things, I guess. They certainly, I just think, are never going to convince people, not least, you know, because we as an industry cover things through conflict. He's going to be in conflict with the Corbynites throughout this parliament because, because of the way both he and they handled the EHRC report on the day itself. And that means then it doesn't matter what he says, we will always, I think, as an industry, write him up as being to the right of where he actually is. So I think he therefore like needs to try and win from that position, not from that policy position, but from that vibe. He's not going to be able to change, you know, what people are never going to believe in Keir Starmer is exciting in the same way than quite wonkish people like me, people still don't really believe Cameron was like a massively radical and transformative right-wing politician. You kind of got to dance with the vibe that you bring.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Anoush Shakelian, and my colleagues Alva Ray and Stephen Bush. You can find me on Twitter at Anoush_C.
You can find me on Twitter at PronouncedAlva.
And you can find me on Twitter at StephenKB.
We're produced by Chris Stone, and our music is Devil with the Devil, licensed under Creative Commons. Please leave us a review and don't forget to subscribe.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Freddie here. I want to tell you about a new way you can support the New Statesman's independent journalism. Every morning I send out Morning Call, our daily newsletter covering everything you need to know about British politics. It's free to sign up, plus for just £3 a month, you'll get a recommended daily piece of ours sent to you in full, plus exclusive polling analysis from Ben Walker, a weekly update from Will Dunn, and our featured piece on Sundays. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love Morning Call. Head to morningcall.substack.com and subscribe now.